Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 47 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the poet Hilary Davis speaks with Julia Coppice about the long poem's role in the literary landscape and discusses her own long poem, Imperium.
Hilary Davis is a poet, translator and critic. She has published three collections of poetry with Enith Arman, the Shanghai owner of the Bonsai Shop, In a Valley of This Restless Mind, and Imperium, which appeared in 2005. Hilary worked for many years as a teacher of French and German, including a spell as head of languages at St Paul's Girls' School in London. And she also co-founded and edited the poetry magazine Argo for 12 years. I met with Hilary to talk about the changing status of the long poem through the years, about why many of her own long poems focus on significant moments in history, and what the long poem can bring to our appreciation of past events. Hilary, I'd like to start by thinking about the popularity of the long poem. I mean, to start with the practicalities, long poems, whether they're sequences or single pieces, are not all that easy to place in literary magazines. And editors would argue that this is largely due to a lack of space. Do you think that there could or should be more shop windows for the long poem?
Yes, I do think that there is an opening for that. There was some years ago a sort of loose grouping of poets who published something called the Long Poem Newsletter, in which they discussed what the nature of long was. It ends up being a little bit like how long is a piece of string? What is a long poem? I think the possibilities of e-zines, online publishing, there could be actually much more fruitful in terms of publication for longer poems, because by definition they don't have the same constraints as your hard copy small poetry magazine, where one understands that if an editor's got only 70 pages to play with, perhaps he, she is reluctant to devote 15 pages just to one person or one poem. Why publishers are not publishing long poems as part of collections begs other questions. And I think that comes perhaps to a new point about whether or not the short lyric for the poetry competition has sort of directed in some way a little bit what people perceive as popular poetry.
So do you think that the short lyric poem is more popular than the long poem?
I think it's what people immediately think of when they think of a poem, yes, certainly. And that wasn't necessarily true in earlier centuries.
So the fact that the long poem doesn't appear much in magazines and is therefore relatively unfamiliar could account in part for its comparative lack of popularity as a genre. But of course, as you're suggesting, in times gone by, it was both more popular and more widespread as a form. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
I think that possibly was still due to the fact that epic was taught, perhaps in schools. Anybody who had any pretensions to being literary would be steeped in some of the great epics. It was regarded as a genre which one could aspire to, or at least one was familiar with. I think that's much less true universally now. Some people do, some people don't. And so that tradition has to some extent been lost. I'm sure that that's one reason for it. And another reason may be shifts in culture, shifts in reading culture, the soundbite, the fact that we're all living faster, our media is faster, all manner of things are faster, and maybe we demand shorter pieces for that. Whereas when the only medium for amusement in the evenings was reading or performing music privately, that's what people did. And so their concentration spans were different, and I do mean that quite seriously.
So you're saying that in this age of the text message and the tweet and the soundbite, there's something about the extra energy that's required to read a long poem that perhaps puts people off trying in the first place?
Or perhaps not the extra energy, but the extra time. You need a little bit longer and a little bit more quiet, and the world is a noisy place and a distracted place. And you do need to be able to sit down and have some kind of space, I think, to read a longer poem. People perhaps don't have that space.
Mimi Calvati has written that the long poem is as much a space in which to flex one's muscles, grapple with problems and identify weaknesses, as it is to mine rich seams, give sway to obsessions and vent to narrative. What would you say, Hilary, is the lure for you in writing long poems?
I would rather agree with what she says about flexing one's muscles. It allows you to expand upon themes which are simply not treatable in the short lyric, so that you are able to sustain poetic discussion. By that I don't mean logical, argumentational discussion, but poetic discussion of longer themes, be they political, historical, social, spiritual. Those kind of themes which you cannot show the modulations, the ups and downs of the human spirit, if you like, in a short lyric, or you need a whole sequence of short lyrics in which to do that, or some kind of sustained poetic discussion. And yes, sometimes narrative is the vehicle that you want to hang it on or use for it, sometimes not.
While I was reading your long poems, I thought of Ezra Pound, who coined the phrase "tale of the tribe" to describe one of the functions of the long poem, which is to tell a story that embraces a whole culture's values and history. So Pound used the phrase "tale of the tribe" to talk about his own long poem, The Cantos, and he alludes in The Cantos, just as you do in your own poems, to specific historical events. He also uses a similarly wide range of geographical reference: Italy, France, England, the United States. How much, if at all, of an influence has Ezra Pound been on your own work?
Not great. He's always there as an example, certainly. What's interesting about the cantos is how he wrestled and wrestled and wrestled with them, and of course eventually they went into the sand, possibly because what he was trying to do simply was too big for any one person. The long poem doesn't mean that it doesn't have its limits. I have found that I need the famous objective correlative in order to give it some kind of structure.
So, Hilary, sorry to interrupt, but could you just explain what you mean by the objective correlative?
Yes, it's a phrase coined by Eliot, and it really refers to the metaphor or what is outside the poet, what he or she can see or experience, around which the poem that he or she is trying to write can crystallise. So it's, I suppose, a little bit like the irritating grain of sand that, around which the oyster forms the pearl. That's the hope that you write a pearl. So having some kind of framework on which to hang your poem.
And Hilary, to talk about your own long poem, Imperium, that can also be seen as a tale of the tribe, to go back to Ezra Pound's phrase. And it ends, "O Britannia, O gentes, in on the tide rushes empire, life cord to Europe's dark heart." And as we know, it was as a result of the Napoleonic Wars, which your poem is about, that the British Empire became the foremost world power for the next century. But then, of course, afterwards it was just a little island once again. So it's interesting to me that you decided to tell this particular story in the middle of the history of Britain. Could you say a little bit about that and how you conceived of the poem?
I suppose the original inspiration was a childhood enthusiasm for Nelson. As a child, I grew up near Greenwich, and I used to pester my father to take me to see the displays of Nelson, the blood-stained uniform, the bullet hole, and so on. But, of course, when I came to think about using him as a metaphor many years later, it very quickly turned into being an examination of what he stood for, the nature of empire, how empires rise, what it is they need to do in order to maintain themselves, the nature of global trade, globalisation, and how eventually they carry the seeds of their own destruction within them. And I was very interested also in the way colonial narratives downplay those narratives of the people that they conquer or perceive as conquered.
Yes, that's interesting what you say about carrying the seed of their own destruction within themselves. Could you say a little bit more about that?
empires tend to be, particularly marine empires at least, tend to be tentacular because they're reaching over such enormous distances. And the same is true of continental empires, if you think of the Roman Empire. You get larger and larger, and I think there comes a moment where the mass ratio is too great and they start to implode. And the other interesting thing is that the collapse of empire carries with it the seeds of lots of other people's destruction as well. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily saying that empire is always a bad thing, and no empire and nationalism is always a good thing. Mm. We can see what happens with the rise of nationalisms as well in the sort of course of the 19th and 20th centuries. But Britain is my history, if you like. Mm-hmm. It's what I know, it's what I have in my blood. And so this critique of empire came out, as it were, naturally from that.
Now, we'll talk in a bit more detail in a minute about Imperium, but to go back to the idea of the long poem in its own right, some critics of the form, Edgar Allan Poe is one of them, have said that the emotional intensity involved within a shorter lyric poem is impossible to maintain over the length of the long poem. How would you respond to that criticism?
If he means pure lyric intensity, then I suppose he's stating the obvious. The question is, does it matter? The two kinds of poem are trying to do two different kinds of things. Mm. So obviously a lyric poem can do something, that goosebump, that burst of recognition, the sheer beauty of words which have been put together in a short lyric poem, which hang in the memory forever and ever. At the same time, treatment of a major human theme is also something which can hang in the mind forever. And having a big structure with a whole variety of different metaphors, each of which may be very valid, can build into an architectonic, which is also very impressive. It impresses differently, though.
And those moments of emotional intensity can be present in the longer poem, but they're present in bursts rather than, you know, sustained throughout the whole length. And what you're saying is that doesn't necessarily matter, it's just that it's a different beast.
Yes.
I'd like to talk now in more detail about Imperium, the title piece from your latest collection. It's a sort of broken narrative set during the Napoleonic Wars, and the poem takes us to many different places, from Chatham Docks to Egypt via Glamorgan. Now, I imagine there must be a fair amount of research involved in writing a poem, grounded in fact to the extent that this one appears to be, and which presumably relies on historical sources.
Yes, that poem, and indeed others I've written, is based on an enormous amount of hard fact historical research. It could be, for example, histories of the British Navy, which I certainly looked at. I looked at how ships were built, where they were sourced from. It involved looking at geographical woodcutting in this country, all kinds of splicings of strange main braces and joints here and there, a use of naval vocabulary of the period, how the Navy was fed, and surprisingly well fed compared to the general populace, contrary to what people sometimes think. How, in fact, for example, also punishment was meted out carefully most of the time. It wasn't just, you know, flogging men from the yardarm at every possible opportunity, which is what you might think if you watch Mutiny on the Bounty too often. So that some surprising conclusions came out of it. I also had to look and read all of Nelson's letters, published letters, other memoirs from the period, biographies of Lady Hamilton. I had to read quite a lot about European history of the time, the history of the Two Sicilies.
Is it a part of the process that you enjoy? Because you seem to be talking about it with enthusiasm. You like doing that,
right? I do relish it, because I find that I get my imagination further and further and further in. So I suspect it's a little bit like some novelists, in fact.
Yes.
The descriptions I've read of how novelists research, or indeed even biographers, that you start to live the life of your protagonist, or you live in the society that you are trying to depict.
So you become thoroughly immersed.
Thoroughly out of your own self.
Yeah.
You lose your own ego, and I think the ego can be one of the bugbears of the lyric poem. I'm not saying it necessarily should be or has to be, but it can be. And you do lose your ego doing this kind of research.
Do you think that's what you've just said about the lyric poem? Do you think that's particularly true when the poem is spoken in the first person, when it uses that lyric I.
It can be, although that lyric I can also be the narrative I, if you think about Browning, who got it down to a fine art. So the I of the narrator doesn't have to be the actual I of the author. Yeah. No, it doesn't. It can be another voice that he or she adopts. Yeah.
But to me, it sounds surprising what you say about the ego, because in a way, the idea of a long poem feels very grandiose.
I mean, I think obviously in the long poem, even though it appears to have nothing to do with the writing I is recognising something of its own experience as it writes the long poem. But I suppose you're not obviously drawing from events in your own experience if you're writing a long poem which has been researched about another historical period. Though the reasons why you chose that have to be personal, obviously.
I mean, I fairly recently wrote a poem based on the myth of Hera and Leander, and concentrating on the moment when she waits for Leander on a stormy night to swim to her. And as we know, if we know the myth, he loses his way halfway across the sea and drowns. And so you would assume that I wasn't in that poem at all. But in fact, I think the emotional link for me was that I had waited on a dark night similarly, fraught with danger, although of a less physical kind, perhaps, for somebody else. And so, although I'm speaking through Hero's voice, I'm very present in that poem. And a poem similarly that might appear very obviously to be about the poet may not be.
True. And I think, again, to turn it sort of back to the idea of the long poem appearing to be about things on the world stage, nevertheless, the original inspirations may come from a place visited, an enthusiasm, such as I mentioned, a childhood enthusiasm for a particular thing, the watching of boats coming in and up and down the Thames, even something as minor as a sort of Thames boat ride when one was little, which fired the imagination out into the bigger picture, if you like.
Now, Imperium is written in 14 sections, and the sections are all narrated by different speakers. One of the things you achieve by using this range of voices is to present the narrative from different angles. At one point, we're listening to the shipwrights working on the docks at Chatham. The next moment, it's munitions workers in Glamorgan. And then there's an officer addressing commissioners of the Admiralty at Whitehall. There's no doubt that the effect is both dizzying and stimulating. But could you tell us what your own reasoning was for using such a large and varied cast of characters in this particular poem?
That's a most interesting question, because I don't think that I consciously set out to use an officer at the Admiralty, a munitions worker. The atmosphere and the place that I wanted to evoke each time in each section presented itself through different voices. Perhaps a good example is when it came to the Battle of Trafalgar, the idea of doing a set piece on Nelson getting shot at the Battle of Trafalgar was an obvious no-no, because it's too obvious. There's no way you can cope with such a well-known event head-on without landing yourself in the middle of a mud pie of cliché. And so I spent some time thinking, how am I going to address this? Eventually, I landed upon the French marksman before he takes a shot. He doesn't know, of course, as the man never did, who he was going to shoot. He was just interested in picking off officers on the deck. That was his job.
Now, T.S. Eliot uses a range of different voices in The Wasteland, but it's generally said that the poem has only one central consciousness. And more recently, the poet Alice Oswald introduced her book-length poem Dart by saying that the poem is made from the language of people who live and work on the Dart. And she says, "There are indications in the margin where one voice changes into another. These do not refer to real people or even fixed fictions. All voices should be read as the river's mutterings." Again, it's that same idea of one central consciousness. In that case, it's the river. Would you say your own poem also has a central consciousness in the way that these other poems do? Or were you aiming to do something slightly different in telling the story from different angles?
I don't think I conceived of it quite as a mosaic. The central thread, I suppose, or the central character around which I wanted all the others to crystallise, is a figure like Nelson. Nelson is never mentioned by name. If you know the Nelson story, you'll recognise that it uses a lot of events from his life, but he's never actually referred to. And I didn't want him to be seen as too obviously the centre of the poem, for the reasons that, I mean, Nelson is one of the most clichéd figures in the whole of British recent history. You know, he was one of the first mega stars, and you have to be very careful when you approach him. So I suppose there was the central character who is the figure of Imperium himself, and it is a man, around which these other aspects of empire crystallise. Mm. And it could be how he treats women, it could be how the empire treats its children, how it treats its sailors, its men, how it treats those that it dominates, even how it treats its ships.
Now, going back to the criticism that's been levelled against the long poem in general, that it's hard to keep up that emotional intensity, it strikes me that in spite of its length, Imperium is very rich in detail and has moments of great intensity. And you're very good at scale too, at showing us the mercurial shifting sizes of things in relation to each other. And you're very good at vivid picture painting. In terms of that picture painting, I'm thinking now of the section that's narrated by David Davies, the foundry worker. And this section, the section that I'll ask you to read in a moment for us, ends just before the only mention of Lord Nelson in the poem, in which he appears as a public figure. So just before you read, could you tell us about the background to that section of the poem?
Yes, this was an attested visit that Nelson made to the Welsh Valleys, just at the sort of early height, if you like, of the Industrial Revolution. The coal had been discovered, the iron ore had been discovered, and of course the enormous boost to this was given by the Napoleonic War, when munitions and all kinds of machinery was needing to be produced. And it was recognised that South Wales was contributing greatly to the war machine. Nelson had connections through Lady Hamilton's nephew. He partly owned the docks out at Milford Haven. So Nelson was invited to visit Milford Haven, which he called, incidentally, the best natural harbour in the world, and then went east on his way home, visiting the South Wales coal valleys as he went.
And would you read a short part of that section for us?
Certainly. So this is a foundry worker evoking Nelson's visit, his memory of Nelson's visit. All up and down where fields were, said the owners, more and more coal must come and feed the forges grown huge as cathedrals, the men like insects day and night beneath the chimneys. And then the streets. It is another sort of village now, bloated from all proportion, turned to grey except for the nightly burning mountain. And where the salmon used to rise, back-to-back houses, bedrooms sweet with sickness, the women gone rotten from dragging coal trolleys and the too much drink.
I love that sense of history standing side by side with itself, where the salmon used to rise back-to-back houses, for example, and also what you do with the proportions, the forges grown huge as cathedrals and the men like insects day and night beneath the chimneys. Wonderful. Now, perhaps surprisingly, history is very popular at the moment as a subject, and there are some wonderful books around, both factual and fictional. I'm thinking of Hilary Mantel's trilogy about Thomas Cromwell, for instance, and there are also several fascinating TV programmes that have been on recently, Mary Beard's series about the Romans, and we've had Helen Castor on Life in Medieval Times, Simon Sharma on the History of Britain, and so on. But is there something particular, do you think, something other that the long poem can bring to our appreciation of past events?
I think the long poem is, in some sense, a distillation of historical events. Historians, I'm sure, also think, and correctly, that they too distill past events, and that they too are interpreting events. But I think by definition they have to have an overarching concern for the narrative and how things are actually played out in real life, and the chronological order, cause and effect, which you don't have to have in a long poem because you can juxtapose, you can shift things about. And it's distilling the essence of the theme that you've chosen rather than having to stick to a chronology or a teleology. Perhaps a good example would be the narrative effect of Turner's famous painting, The Fighting Temeraire. People often forget, or perhaps even don't know, that the full title is The Fighting Temeraire, Tugged to Her Last Berth to Be Broken Up. And therein lies the narrative. But that appears to depict two ships. One is a ghost of her former self. The other is the Industrial Revolution upon us. The former is one of the great ships that fought at Trafalgar.
And I suppose if you don't know that story, the story
you
behind
don't
it,
get half of the point of the picture.
You don't get the full force.
And you don't get the distillation of this is a change in empire and it's a change in our society from the great sailing ships to the coal-fueled steamship. And it's a lament for the time of the sail ships. So there's an enormous amount to be read into what people have often just seen as a very beautiful image. It is a sociological comment, it's a political comment, it's a technological comment, but of course it's also a great romantic painting.
And the long poem too can be...
can be those things.
Those things.
Yes.
Hilary, thank you very much for talking to us.
I was talking to the poet and critic Hilary Davies, and the poem we discussed in this podcast, Imperium, can be found in Hilary's poetry collection of the same name, which was published by Ennis Arman in 2005.
That was Hilary Davies in conversation with Julia Copus. You can find out more about Hilary on the RLF website. Her surname is spelt D-A-V-I-E-S. And that concludes episode 47, which was recorded by Julia Copus and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 48, the poet, novelist and librettist Ron Butlin speaks with Kona McPhee about how he came to be such a diverse writer, his differing experiences of writing in Scots and English, and the importance of music. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.